You're listening to The Source on Utah Public Radio. I'm Jennifer Pemberton, and I'm joined in the studio by Roger Kellgren and Simon Wong, who, among many other roles at Utah State University and in the state of Utah, belong to a research group called the Wasatch Dendroclimatology Research Group, which is WADR for short, W-A-D-R, which on the radio sounds exactly like water, W-A-T-E-R.
Well, we do want to emphasize the D in there, so WADR.
WADR. So if you hear us saying the Water Research Group, it's not the generic Water Research Group. So maybe we could just start with each of you introducing yourself and talking about what you do specifically for the research group, what your role is, how you got involved. Something like that, and we will start with Dr. Kellgren.
I'm Roger Kellgren. I'm a professor in plant soils and climate. My expertise is tree physiology, and it's throughout my career I focused on water relations, so how trees use water and what happens when they run out of water. And 4 years ago, the next logical step was, geez, I look at that in urban landscapes, but if we look at it in a natural setting and the trees don't grow very much, it tells us what happened with the water. And so it was kind of a meeting of the minds. The stars were in alignment. And a group of us, another group on campus, Tammy Rittenauer in geology, had just gotten a small grant to study tree rings. So we all got together and said, we have a lot of interest. And there's a huge gap in terms of tree ring reconstructions and tree ring chronologies, which is what we use. It's the pencil-thin core that we pull out of a tree, measure the rings. We do 20 or 30 of them, and we have a chronology. There was none in northern Utah. And here we have a need to understand this climate, and we don't have any way to do it, so we all saw the need to collect tree cores and develop reconstructions. And so our colleague Justin DeRose in the Forest Service, who is a tree ring person through and through, I'm just a dilettante, and Matt Becker, also a tree ring person, have gone out and collected the cores, processed it, and then Simon takes the cores and the reconstructions of climate and then sleuths out and mines interesting insights from that data.
Dr. Wong, do you want to talk about a little bit more about your role and what happens when you get that information from the field?
Hi, my name is Simon Wong. I'm technically a meteorologist by training. So my work in research-wise usually touches water before they hit the ground. So something that generates rainfall, snowfall, and that trace into storm, and what forms the storm, and then, you know, and you can go from there, atmospheric process, ocean process, that's usually the things that I do. Doing those research is fun, but as you know, the first operational satellite wasn't there until, you know, late 70s. That means we have really little data compared to long records like tree ring can offer. And to understand climate variability, climate change, we need a lot of data, which we don't have. So the tree ring research that Roger has just mentioned really filled in this gap. It allows us to understand or verify, you know, what we have been seeing for the past 30, maybe 40 years of variability holds true in the past for the past, you know, couple hundred years or even longer. We have used a existing chronology, meaning the tree ring data from the Uinta basins. It was done by another group outside Utah. But we found that it was really excited and encouraging to find that the patterns, the cycles that we have noticed for the past 60 years actually is very well recorded through our 763 years of records.
It's interesting that we have, in recent years, such sophisticated equipment to monitor and see data in climate and all of this information, all of these instruments, and they don't go back very far. And in the meantime, we've had trees that have been recording data in the same way that a stream gauge or a precipitation gauge or a snow tell would have done if it had been invented when the trees were actually recording this information. Maybe, Roger, you could talk a little bit about the history of when people started looking to trees to answer some of these questions, or maybe when we realized that trees had the answers to some of these questions.
It actually started at the turn of the century in Arizona, in studying or archaeological studies of Pueblo, Navajo, some of the Native American settlements in that part of the country, where a perceptive researcher noticed that tree rings varied from year to year. And he started to peek at the weather records of rainfall and noted that there was a relationship between the width of the rings and the annual rainfall. And that actually meshed quite well with what we understand, even at that time, that if plants don't get water, they don't grow very well. If you don't water your turf grass, it'll eventually die. But these trees are adapted to drought, so they don't die. But if they don't get water, they simply don't grow. And so this individual then was basically the catalyst for it. And to this day, the University of Arizona in Tucson then is kind of the citadel of tree ring research. And then since then, it's spread to other parts of the country. There's a strong program in Arkansas, one at Columbia University, and then around the world, because it's the only way to pull back the curtain of time and understand what climate has been doing past our historical record. What has expanded the field is that they use the tree rings as a proxy for other water-related features and phenomenon. So they found early on that if you took the tree ring width and looked at the stream flow, the flow of a river, they matched up. Well, the trees aren't really pulling water out of the river, but the same weather factors that if you have a low snowfall year and the tree runs out of water fast, doesn't grow very much, means there's less runoff. And so there's less water in the rivers. So the tree rings are a proxy for factors like stream flow and maybe, for example, snowpack, that they don't directly measure it, but they're being affected by the same factors, so they can represent these other weather-based, climate-based features that we're interested in.
So the research project that the water group, the mm-hmm. water research group, mm-hmm. water as in dendroclimatology, water with a D.
Bingo.
What that group has been doing is reconstructing stream flows historically. Mm-hmm. So taking rivers and showing sort of volume of how much water was in the river and therefore how much water had fallen as precipitation in the previous months or years. Or mm-hmm. if we have a stream flow reconstruction mm-hmm. for a specific watershed or a river, maybe this is a question for Simon, how do we recreate climate from looking at a stream flow? It's just one set of data, mm-hmm. But it seems like it's the culmination of a lot of information. So how do you decode that stream flow reconstruction and sort of see the bigger picture of what climate was like?
Well, stream flow basically is an accumulation of rainfall eventually, and it's accumulation of a lot of rainfall over a, you know, extensive land, a watershed. So it's actually a very good variable, because if you notice rainfall, you will know that the rain gauge from your backyard and comparing that to the rain gauge from your neighbor's yard will be different, because the rainfall pattern is quite sparse. I mean, it's quite chaotic. So we have found through all the little papers published by the water group, three different watersheds from northern Utah to south northern Utah. And you will see that although all the three different rivers shows a slightly different patterns, they also have the consistent variations. Those are the climate signals that we know is not just local, but on a regional base. Regional means can be a statewide or can be the whole region-wide for the Western U.S. And me as a meteorologist and also the Climate Center staff researchers, we are meteorologists in training to look after the forcing the mechanisms of these kind of signals.
There's been a few of these reconstructions have been published so far, the Weber River and the Logan River and the Great Salt Lake mm-hmm. water level. The Bear River is
just came out.
Before these stream flow reconstructions came out, what kind of data sets what were you looking at? Because when you see them as a chart, peak flow, up, down, up, down, it seems really compelling to sort of see highs and lows and all of those patterns. What kind of data did you have before the tree ring reconstructions or these water reconstructions to look at to see historical patterns?
You have gauge, so that's instrument data. And we all know instrument comes with civilization. So they can only go back for as long as the people place them. So those are the only data we could use. So those are usually very short.
So now that we can see deeper into the past, it seems like the short-term patterns, we sort of thought we knew what they looked like. And then all of a sudden, when you see back 1,000 years, those patterns don't look quite the same. I know with the Bear River reconstruction, that a lot of that became very pronounced, that we realized the last 50 years have been pretty wet.
Some of the second wettest, I think, in the past 1,200 years.
And maybe from standing where we stand right now, it doesn't really seem that wet. It's all about context, right?
Things are changing. I think one of the key points that was made in the Bear River reconstruction paper is that things seem to shift in a millennial sense around the year 2000. Now, that wasn't a Y2K issue. It was simply that it seems like we've been getting drier. And actually throughout the West for the past 15 years, the Colorado River has been hit hard by the same trend, that overall flows are lower than they were up to the year 2000. Occasional years like 2011 are wet, but overall it's lower. You just have to see the bathtub ring at Lake Mead to know that no, they haven't been getting quite what they used to.
Or the Great Salt Lake. Right.
Yeah, that's a bit scary. It's more than a bit scary with the Great Salt Lake.
What are the plans for the Water Research Group? What other data are it sort of planned to go after?
Our next goal is to reconstruct the Provo River. And the Provo River is, I wouldn't say it's a mess. It's just complicated. Because the population center of the Wasatch Front is in the southern end, Utah County and Salt Lake County. But that's where the least water is. And so the Provo River is actually an extremely important artery, if you will, supplying water to the entire Wasatch, or the Salt Lake County, Utah County, because it itself, it doesn't have much water. But a big chunk of water is moved over from the Uinta Basin into the Provo, and that water ends up on the lawns in Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County. And also, the Provo there's a big straw that goes from the Weber River into the Provo. So 80 years ago, somebody thought that was a good idea. The people in the South End don't think that way now, but they still pull a big chunk of water out of the Weber River way up high, and that goes into the Provo. So there's three different sources of water going into the Provo, and then that water ends up in Utah County and Salt Lake County.
And that's the last big river in northern Utah?
Well, actually, no, because Salt Lake City itself gets, I don't know, I think about 40% of its water from the streams like City Creek east of Salt Lake in the mountains. And so I think that would be the last one, is to see how the tree rings relate to these smaller creeks that supply a good chunk of water to Salt Lake City.
It seems very obvious, the implications of this research for water resource managers in the state, in the West. Who else is this research for? What are the other applications of this research?
Everybody has a stake in this. And so what part of our job is to translate this to a level that everyone can understand, because everyone has a stake in it. And everyone, through awareness, can make choices that would benefit the society at large. So it really is everybody. I know that sounds kind of like a let's hold hands and sing kumbaya, but it really is. It really is for everybody.
Simon, what do you want to do with this research?
We have seen promise. We have done analysis, but we are trying to break the mold of the convention of thinking of this dendrochronology. We may not need to really go and be selective. We can just randomly sample trees. This is directed against the conventional thinking of finding the right place, finding the right species, and pick up the most climate-sensitive trees. I wouldn't say this revolutionary because this all our dendrochronology approach, but the thinking is different, approach is different. The things we can look at is will be different. Because by doing this, the FIA program has collected thousands, actually tens of thousands, of tree cores awaiting analysis. And it's labor intensive. But the trade-off is you no longer are restricted to one watershed or one stream. You have data points covering the entire Western United States. So we can create a very good map and data resource for our climate, stream, soil moisture, snowpack, etc., back to the past.
So the FIA, the Forest Inventory, is like a census of
yes.
trees in the West, right? Mm-hmm. And all of that information is like all the demographic information.
Exactly.
So in the same way that the census would say how old people are and what jobs they have
yes.
and where they live and how many acres they
yes.
have, and this says mm-hmm. tells us that about trees.
So that would be what I call a water big data project.
That's very big data.
this forest inventory assessment was actually mandated by Congress. So the United States can get an understanding of its forest resources. So it really is a very, very big project across, I think, every state that has a tree, I think. And so it's a very, very large data set, and we're simply mining that in a way that no one has thought about before.
And we're trying to really try to convince the mainstream tree-ring scientist that this can work. We haven't been so successful yet in convincing. We have been successful in showing that they do pick up very good climate signals like precipitation and snowpack.
Well, in using, I think, a species like Utah juniper, which was very unconventional for tree ring research because a lot of researchers thought that it didn't pick up those signals and that, but is it true that Utah juniper was pretty much used almost exclusively in the Bear River
yes.
recreation?
There was just one site that was used. It was one up by probably about 30 miles northeast of Park City by Colville. And it happens to be a site where the trees were sitting in a bowl, a south-facing bowl, that had basically acted like a solar reflector, putting a whole lot of heat on these trees. And so it's a very stressful site.
I heard that hike was extremely difficult.
You look at the size of the boulders, and yeah, I wasn't on it, but just looking at the pictures made my blood turn cold. But it's an extremely sensitive site because it is one of those that has that particular orientation south, so it's hot. It has a bowl, and so that also traps heat, and it's a fairly steep slope. So it had all the conditions of an extremely stressful site. And then Utah juniper is truly one of the toughest trees out there. Along with cockroaches, it will probably survive a nuclear holocaust.
And yet it's not our state tree.
Well, you know, don't know quite how to answer that one.
It's just a fact. It's not our state tree.
And it's the only tree species that has Utah in its name,
I know,
too.
But school children haven't written a song about it yet.
No,
so
they have not. No, I'm sorry. But they have moved away from Colorado blue spruce, I believe.
Yes, we're on to the aspen now.
Aspen, okay, which is found everywhere in North America.
Which is fine. But I do, the Utah juniper is a really special tree. I mean, not just sort of emotionally, but it's
a tough customer is what it is. Mm-hmm. It actually has a I wouldn't say a unique, but an uncommon water use strategy. It has it's a go for broke, use it or lose it. And what it does, and you can see that just out in nature, it is rarely in competition with other plants. And there's no such thing as Utah juniper forest in the sense that the crowns don't touch. And that's because each tree is beats out the competition. It uses every drop of water it has at the surface, so nothing else can compete. And then it simply hunkers down for the heat of the summer. Okay, aggressive, kind of like the Wall Street of brokers, right?
I was going to say kind of like Utahns in general.
Okay, well, you know, you're the one saying that, not me. So
it's a very pioneering tree.
It's a pioneering. It's a tough cookie. It can tolerate most anything, and it's let's just say it's an entrepreneurial tree species.
Anything else you guys want to add to this conversation? It's been really good stuff. I hope we've gotten a lot of the big picture of the water research group and applications. Is there anything we're missing?
If I may add, being climate scientist, the ultimate goal is to look into the future. All the things we did, no matter how deep or how broad we dig into the past, is just to add that one more knowledge base so that we can look at to the next few months, next few years, next decade with better accuracy. And all this turns into prediction sense, because there has been a saying, the best mitigation strategy or a tool has been good prediction. So you know what is coming. I just want to add that all the efforts that's been put into creating this analysis, prolonging the records, finding more or new signals is to help us look at to the next big events better that way.
Good point. We don't ever study history just for the sake of studying history, right?
Of course.
It's a fascinating program. It's a great project. I thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Jennifer.
That was Roger Kellgren and Simon Wong, researchers at Utah State University who work with tree ring data to help plan for Utah's water future. When The Source returns, we hear from a familiar voice here on Utah Public Radio, meteorologist Danny Berendieran. He's working on reconstructing the history of snowpack in northern Utah's mountains. So in addition to telling us if there's powder in our near future, he might be able to tell us if we've always had the greatest snow on Earth, and if we can expect to keep that slogan in the coming decades. I know if you have any interest in the state's climate future, that is probably what you want to know. So stay tuned.